Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
John Logan is one of the most successful screenwriters ever in Hollywood, and his work, well, it reads like a guide to the best of 21st century cinema. He's also a Tony-winning playwright, so who better to take on the iconic Moulin Rouge movie and turn it into a stage musical? He has done it. It's a hit. It's coming to Dublin this winter, a city he knows well. And speaking to us from California, where it appears he never sleeps, John Logan, good morning.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
Very well, thank you, and very excited to speak to you. And I do believe you have been already up for a number of hours.
I am an early riser. Early to bed and early to rise.
How early?
I usually get up at 4, which tends to intimidate other writers, you know. But I go to bed at like 7, so it's not so miraculous.
Oh, 7? Wow, that's incredible discipline. And you don't drink coffee?
I don't drink coffee, no. But I make it up with Diet Coke, believe me.
So how do dinners and nights out and things like that, when I'm fascinated, I have 7 p.m.
It is, but the irony is whenever I'm doing theatre work, like Moulin Rouge, that's a nighttime occupation because you go to the show, you have notes afterwards. So I'm sort of like, I have a vampire schedule some of the time, and then I have a Frankenstein monster schedule the other half of the time.
Links to everything there already. John, we've been obviously loving your work for many, many years, and there is this, I think, distinctly Irish sense of longing in much of what you write. There's a very good reason for this, isn't there? Because you're surrounded by Irish people in your life.
I am. I mean, my parents are from Belfast and Coleraine. Mm-hmm. All my family is there, except my immediate brothers and sisters. And my husband is from Dublin. His whole family is from Dublin. So I have the entire island covered. And I spent 3 years shooting Penny Dreadful out at Ardmore.
You did.
So, you know, I am deeply steeped in Ireland, which is why I'm so thrilled. The minute I heard that Moulin Rouge was opening in Dublin, I got in touch, said I need to be there. You know, I need to see it in the Borgash, in a theater that I know so well, in a city that I love.
The fact that you even know it, naming it after the Irish former gas company, says how well you know Dublin. And also, you ignore the other cities. You just go, Dublin, that's the only one I'm going to go see.
Well, honest to gosh, yes. I mean, like, Moulin Rouge is playing in so many places all over the world, which is, of course, thrilling for all of us who created it. But, you know, once you've seen it about 8,000 times in New York and London, you're like, okay, I'm pretty familiar with Moulin Rouge, but this is a new company in Dublin. It's our international touring company, so it's all new performers doing it, which is thrilling. Thrilling for them, because they get to discover the piece anew, and thrilling for people like me who created it all those many years ago to see fresh interpretations of the show.
I want to ask about your parents, because it's a fascinating story here. They leave Belfast in, I think it's the 1950s, it's post-war, isn't it?
Yes, they left. You know, my dad went into the Harlan & Wolff shipyards when he was 16.
Yeah.
And sort of learned to be a naval engineer there. And they left for that sort of reputed better life over in North America. And they went to Canada first and then to California, where my brother and I were born. So I am a native Californian, a native Los Angelino, you know, but half of my heart is always there in Ireland, I'll tell you.
And your dad, he would have worked in Harlan & Wolff, as you say, it went into decline in those kind of 50s into the 60s because of air travel and so on. But he does go back, doesn't he, at least once to Belfast?
Yeah, he went. It was interesting for us, you know, being from the north, the Troubles were a very complicated issue in our household because my aunts and uncles and beautiful people I love, my grandparents all lived in Belfast. So the Troubles were thorny, you know, and my dad went back once. Mm-hmm. During the Troubles. And he was so shocked at, you know, to see police checkpoints and people carrying automatic weapons, which by the way, is exactly how I feel, you know, here in America since 9/11. The first time I walked to an airport and saw a soldier with a machine gun, right. I just thought, where am I living? So, but, you know, I went to Ireland as a kid when I was 4, pre-Troubles. Mm-hmm. And then obviously been back many times since.
But you have memories, or do you distinct memories? Because I think the traditions of your father's family were on the loyalist side. So there were orange parades, things like that in your childhood memories.
Yeah, I sort of blush to tell my Dublin family, my Catholic family, that I wore the sash and banged the drum in the parade. But I was young. You know.
Looked adorable doing it.
Yeah, I looked adorable doing it, exactly. But, you know, as I don't need to tell you, it's a different world now in Ireland. And it's, you know, I wish my father could have lived to see it, because it's so exciting to see the virtual reunification of the country and the ease that you can move between the borders. I mean, after the war, you know, my mother was smuggling sausages from Dublin to Belfast, you know, in her handbag. Yeah. And that was, you know, it's not that world anymore, which is grand.
The unity is, it's economic rather than constitutional, but other matters.
Yes.
And because you're the writer and showrunner on Penny Dreadful, which is an amazing horror series, the fans are devoted. You have one here, John. This meant that you lived in Dublin for a number of years, and this is where you found love.
Yes, exactly. I was over to sort of begin working on Penny Dreadful in Dublin, because we decided to film in Dublin because there's better Victorian architecture in Dublin than there is in London. So right. it was easier to shoot there. And plus, I had such a draw to spend some time there. Mm-hmm. And the week before we started shooting, I sort of went out and I met the man who is now my husband a week before we started shooting.
Wow.
So, you know, it was miraculous in many ways. I was in my homeland. I was shooting my first TV show, and I met the man who became my husband all within a week. So it was a momentous week.
You didn't go to bed at 7 p.m. that week.
I certainly did not, let me tell you.
That's the lovely Tommy. Is it Tommy Tong? Is that
Tommy Tonge? Yes.
Tommy Tonge.
And if you want to meet him, Tommy and all the Tonges will be at the Dublin opening on November 27th. I'm bringing a huge group to see the work.
Because that's
the other thing that's sort of fascinating is when you do a piece of theater, when you do a movie, everyone in the world can see it. When you do a piece of theater, well, if you can get to New York, you can see it on Broadway. Or if you can get to the West End, you can see it in London. But the rest of the world doesn't get a chance. So when a touring show like Moulin Rouge goes to places like Edinburgh or Dublin, and after Dublin, it's going to Switzerland, to Zurich, it's very exciting for everyone who worked on the show, because a new audience is going to get to see it. And theater, as you know, only exists in real time with those actors and that audience for that 2 hours. So that's why I'm so excited to see it with I hope will be a very enthusiastic Dublin audience.
Oh, you bet. Since it feels like I'm talking to a local, do you know where in Dublin Tommy is from?
Oh, yeah. He's from the suburbs by the Blanchardtown Mall.
Oh, really? That's very specific.
Yeah, it's very specific, because when we used to visit his parents, you know, we would go to the Blanchardstown Mall all the time to get like smoothies.
Very good. The Blanch, as we know it here.
Oh, we call it the Blanch, do we? Okay.
Some people do. But you mentioned this is your love on stage, isn't it? And you always wanted to be involved. It was acting, first of all, you thought might be your life?
Yeah, when you fall in love with theatre, you know, you instinctively think, oh, I need to be up there playing Hamlet, you know, or I need to be up there singing and dancing, because that's the point of access to a kid is the characters and the actors. But so I thought, oh, well, that's what I wanted to do. And I was a very theatrical child. I would put on little plays. I loved doing sort of ventriloquism and dressing up. But, you know, the minute I got to Northwestern University, where I went to school, mm-hmm. I quickly realized I was not an actor, because, you know, there were real actors like Julia Louis-Dreyfus was in my class and Dennis O'Hare was in my class. And when you see people who just their molecules respond to the stage in a way that is transcendent, you realize those are actors. But thankfully, I fell into a playwriting class. And from that day to this, it's been over 40 years now. I've never wanted to do anything but be a dramatist.
It's been going well.
It's been going well.
You were very mature to make that decision.
Yeah, but it was slotting into the plot proper lane. And what I always say, which is, again, this comes down to my parents and to Ireland. You know, I was raised with British literature and with poetry. Mm-hmm. And my dad loved Shakespeare, even though he, you know, was a naval engineer and was in shipyards every day of his life, first as a worker, then as a designer. He loved Shakespeare, and he introduced me to Hamlet, to Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, that amazing film. And that's the thing that sort of sparked my love of creativity. And that was about language, and that was about a playwright. And so again,
he sat you down and got you to watch Laurence Olivier.
He sat me down. I was like going out to play. They would play like Star Trek or something. He was like, no, you have to sit and watch this movie. And it was an afternoon, and this was in San Pedro, California. I remember it so distinctly. We didn't have a black and white TV, which was fine because the movie's in black and white, so you have to watch this movie. And it was Olivier's Hamlet. And for a kid seeing the ghosts, the sword fight, you know, it's so entrancing on just an entertainment level. And then there's this other thing, which is called Shakespeare, you know, and it's poetry, and you're hearing language you've never heard before. And then, God love my dad, he sat me down. We read like kids' versions of the plays. We then read some of the plays. He like forced me to like find where like Henry V was playing, or Richard III, the other Olivier movie. So he stoked my great love of Shakespeare. And it is Shakespeare that to this day is my lodestar.
So he wasn't shocked when you announced this love of theatre, you wanted to study it and make it your life?
Not at all. Not at all. And my parents would be nothing but supportive. Because, you know, when, you know, I'm sure you were like this, I'm sure many people are like this. Like, when you have a passion to do something, you're going to do it, come hell or high water.
Yeah.
And that's just the simple truth of it. And could I have been sensible and become a lawyer? Sure. But I had this drive to do one thing. And, you know, that's the thing that's been sort of, that's the incendiary spark that's been firing everything I do every single day.
Your parents seem to be kind of exceptional, don't they? Because we think of Ulster parents leaving the north of Ireland to go off to America. They must have been austere from that family tradition. But it was quite easy for you to come out to them, wasn't it?
It was. It was. I mean, I came out late, so during college. You know, and it was a different world, you know, it was just a different world then, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, in terms of, accepting queer culture or gay people. So it was a scary thing. But I think because my parents had, you know, they had lived a life. They had gone from my dad, particularly poverty in Belfast,
right,
to sort of making his way to a different country, to different situations, you know. They understood it was a wide world out there, you know, of many different kinds of people. And one of the things that actually, you know, in Moulin Rouge, I'm most proud of is how we celebrate different genders, different colors, different nationalities.
Yes.
And that's the wonderful thing about Moulin Rouge and about the way I was raised.
Moulin Rouge, it's your second Tony, and it's quite some days, isn't it, from your days in Northwestern, where you're dreaming of being a playwright. And these are tough years as you wait for success to unfold. How long do you work in the law library there?
About 10 years. My day job was working in the Northwestern Law Library, and it was great. You know, I shelved books, I did circulation, you know, I did all the things you do as sort of a flying winged monkey in a library. But it allowed me to have a tiny little apartment and to write plays. And so I wrote 14 plays, just one after another, and some of them were put on. And you know, Chicago then was and still is a vibrant theater city, and Steppenwolf Theater had just exploded. There were exciting theaters popping up and falling down all the time. So it was a thrilling time to be young and to want to be in show business. I liken it to it was my sort of Paris in the 20s, because everyone was creative, everyone was trying crazy things and writing plays and acting and doing musicals. So I didn't mind that I had a day job every day, because I had to pay the rent, and writing for me has always been a job, you know, and it's a calling, but it's also a job, and it pays, you know, the mortgage now. So I had any expectations of being favored or treated in any special way. I knew I had to work hard and work harder than other people, which is what I tried to do for those many years.
And that's what you did. And the awards have come. Moulin Rouge, it's such an iconic Baz Luhrmann film that people would have known. You must have been nervous at the beginning how this would translate into a stage musical.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, everyone who made Moulin Rouge did it because they loved that movie. And, you know, Baz Luhrmann created this remarkable work of cinema. You know, it has so much verve to it. You know, I always say, like, if I meet someone who doesn't love the first 20 minutes of Moulin Rouge, they can't be my friend, because it is cinema at its most explosive.
What a test. You know?
Yeah, it's a total test. That's a line in the sand. And that was well before I worked on the stage show. And, you know, Baz Luhrmann and Craig Pearce wrote an amazingly complicated screenplay. So it was a pleasure to go into the various drafts of the screenplay, to work with Baz, to talk to him about how they developed their show, their movie, and then to work with Alex Timbers and how we would transform that into a work of theatre.
So what do we notice, or what will audiences in Dublin notice is different? Because this has been a mega hit now for, I think, 7 years, touring worldwide. Did you know immediately what you needed to do?
Yeah, honestly, yes. Because, you know, my first conversation with Alex Timbers, the director, I said, look, if this if this show doesn't open with Lady Marmalade, then not only won't I write it, I also won't see it. So we knew we wanted to set it in the Moulin Rouge and make it an immersive event for the audience. And the way the movie is like an immersive event, just sort of washes over you like a tidal wave. So we knew we wanted to encase everything in the sort of the spectacular world of the Moulin Rouge. And so we knew we wanted that point in. And I knew my job was going to be to try to find relations between the characters, because the movie just exists on flash cuts and close-ups and just all this, like the phantasmagoria of cinema. So we needed to translate that into the real-time activities of stage. So it was creating characters, building the relationships between different characters. And I think audiences, you know, will definitely recognize their favorite bits and pieces of the movie. You know, some of the songs, the costumes, the look, the feel. But also they get something new, because we had to create a new plot to satisfy the needs of stage, as opposed to the needs of movie.
Right.
So there's a lot of the old, a lot of the new, and somehow in that combination is Moulin Rouge on stage.
So the story is quite different, isn't it? You've upgraded it, you've changed it, expanded it.
Yes, I have. I have. I had to build more sort of drama into the second act of our show. And to sort of make some of the relationships a little more stage worthy in terms of intensity, because to hold an audience in a dialogue scene or with a relationship in a musical requires you be pretty strong with how you're treating the characters to sort of balance the extraordinary power of the music and the songs. So yeah, I'm inordinately proud of the work of Moulin Rouge, but again, not only my work. I mean, this show was created by a quartet, and that was myself, Alex Timbers, the director, Sonia Tai, the choreographer, and Justin Levine, the music supervisor. It was all four of us working together every single day for years that made this show.
But when the Tonge family are celebrating in the board, gosh, it's just you they're clapping for.
Well, that is true. It'll be nice to take a bow with my family there.
That's the idea. The soundtrack is full of modern pop songs. You've added some more.
Yes. I mean, we thought one of the things we wanted to do was sort of bring some new music, because the movie was from 2001.
Yeah.
And we were approaching it in, you know, 20 years later. So we were able to like go into the songbook of, you know, of Lady Gaga and Rihanna and sort of more modern artists and bring in some more recent hits, which was the most fun, was picking the songs, you know, of just saying like, well, you have every song ever written in the world of music in front of you. So what do you want for your show?
Yeah, difficult.
And with a few exceptions, we managed to get the rights to almost everything. And some of them took a lot of work, mm-hmm. and some of them were surprisingly easy, and a few things we just couldn't get.
Was having a great long run in Dublin. I want to jump back to your days stacking shelves, becoming a playwright, and talk about this amazing film debut, to have Oliver Stone directing, Al Pacino starring, Any Given Sunday. This comes about after a meeting with Oliver Stone in Tokyo, is that right?
Yeah, well, I had written, you know, I wanted to try writing a screenplay, and I love, you know, American football. I don't understand British or Irish football. I'll just swear that right off the opening. But I loved American football, and I wanted to write something about it. So the topic sentence I wrote myself was King Lear in the NFL, the National Football League. So I wrote this script called Any Given Sunday, just wrote it on spec. And my agents got it to Oliver Stone, and he loved it. And he called me while I was working on a play in Adelaide, Australia, and said, come to Tokyo. I got to talk to you about your movie. So 3 days later, I was in Tokyo with Oliver Stone, a starving playwright about to become a screenwriter. And I credit Oliver Stone and Ridley Scott as the two men who taught me how to become a screenwriter, because they took the time to show me how playwriting is different than screenwriting. So those two gentlemen are really in the pantheon of people who have guided me significantly.
One of the great devices to show your flair as a writer is the monologue, isn't it? And Al Pacino's... Yeah, monologue in the dressing room, inch by inch. It's so iconic. That must be very satisfying.
It is. It's very, when you write something like that, you know, or when Maximus and Gladiator says, were you entertained? You know, when you write those kind of lines, you know, you sort of like pat yourself on the back and say, oh, that is definitely cinema worthy. That is screen worthy, that line. And my job always, whether it's a play or a movie or a TV series, is to write great lines for actors. It's all about writing lines for actors. So when you give Al Pacino a speech like that, or you give a great speech to Judi Dench, you know, and they get into it and they enjoy it, you realize you've done your job.
Gladiator is the next movie, isn't it? It's with Ridley Scott. Obviously, this is your first Oscar nomination. The lines are endlessly quotable. Are we not? Is that the one you're most proud of? Or there are so many.
I love that one because of what it says about, you know, Maximus' journey. Yes. But again, you know, Gladiator had two very able, you know, William Nicholson and David Franzoni, the other writers on Gladiator. And we could not have done it without each other. So as much credit to them as to me, 100%.
Now, the very quiet and shy star of the movie, Russell Crowe, has said, even last year he said that he had to rewrite the script each night during filming. The writer of the movie is with us now. What is this about, John Logan?
Oh, look, you know, Russell was very helpful, you know, on occasion. You know, because look, actors have a feel for things that writers don't sometimes. And I will always listen to an actor who says, this line doesn't come out of my mouth comfortably, or can we try something else? I mean, that's how you work in collaboration. So, you know, I think, you know, Russell's fantastic, obviously, and collaboration is sometimes rocky and sometimes exceedingly smooth, but it is always valuable.
His temperament, very evident in those claims that he wrote those lines. Then, of course, The Aviator with DiCaprio. This is your first time working with Martin Scorsese, and you would again with Hugo, which is a beautiful film, and found a child star who's become an adult star. Oscar nominations again, a labour of love here.
Totally. I mean, you know, I grew up admiring the great directors, you know, Orson Welles and Stanley Kubrick and Marty Scorsese. So the chance to work with him on The Aviator and then Hugo was like, it truly was a dream come true. And Marty is one of those people who is exactly like you want him to be. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes when you meet people you really admire, you're like, oh, they're kind of a jerk, or they're kind of boring in real life. Marty Scorsese is firing on all cylinders all the time.
Wow.
So it is a genuine pleasure with him on anything. And obviously, you know, I'm inordinately proud of both those movies, particularly The Aviator, which was 5 years of work and an incredible collaboration with Leonardo DiCaprio all along the way. So it was, it was joyous.
It's DiCaprio, I think it is his best performance. It's amazing he didn't get the Oscar that time. It was extraordinary.
I totally agree with you there.
There are just too many films to go through all of them. You worked with Oliver Scorsese, Tim Burton as well, that's Sweeney Todd, Ridley Scott we mentioned, Sam Mendes as well. Do you have a favourite director?
I admire different directors for different things. Mm-hmm. You know, I would certainly say the film I'm proudest of is The Aviator. You know, but Skyfall was also an extraordinary experience, you know, because Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson were the most supportive producers I've ever worked with or met. And Sam Mendes and I were theater people, you know, and we talked about it as theater people. So that was like, it was weirdly like we were collaborating on a play, you know, that somehow became a movie. And it was, that was probably the most enjoyable experience I've had working in movies was Skyfall.
I mean, it's, everyone says, all the critics, you brought sophistication and depth to James Bond. There's emotional resonance for the first time. It's kind of the first time anyone asks, where does James Bond come from?
Exactly. And you know, the first thing I did when Sam and I first started talking about it is I went back and read all the Ian Fleming books, you know, and Ian Fleming drops fascinating hints about James Bond's past. And then, you know, to get to really explore that and go there and see the grim Scottishness of what that was and how that created this license to kill, sometimes demon, sometimes angel, was a real joy. And again, it was, you're working with Dan Craig, who pound for pound is one of the great actors, you know, and to sit at the table read and, well, there's Dan Craig and there's Javier Bardem and there's Judi Dench and there's you know, it's just the most unbelievable experience for a little theater mouse who grew up loving the theater and loving show business.
It also, that story Skyfall, because it's essentially James Bond's Rosebud, isn't it? The home place. It feels like something only an Irish storyteller would kind of possess the knowledge to do, something that give James Bond this sense of exile, longing to be home, and this sort of chasm that's in his life somehow.
Yeah, look, you know, the Irish poet or poets, you know, have a sensibility, and there's melancholy that is part of it. You know, I was able to use Tennyson, who obviously is not Irish, and his poem Ulysses. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you spend enough time in the misty moors, you know, of the West Country of Ireland, or you know enough Irish people, you understand there's a combination of sort of melancholy and beauty that I think is one of the things we were trying to explore with Skyfall, because it is a very melancholy adult movie in a way for all of it. And that's something that Sam Mendes embraced. That's something that Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson said, yes, create this, because it's different. And the way why James Bond has survived is because he's evolved, and he'd evolved to a point where I was lucky enough to be able to tell part of his story.
You have fears, don't you, about the Amazon conglomerate purchasing Bond as content? It gives you chills.
Well, it did a little bit, you know, because my experience with Bond is Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson, and it was a family business. And truly, as cliche as it sounds, when you work on a Bond movie, you feel you're part of a family, and you're taken care of, and you're embraced in a really warm way. And when they left, you know, the franchise or the character, I felt sad. But look, Amy Pascal is an incredible executive and very creative and smart. And I'm so glad that she's involved in the next steps. I'm excited to see where it goes, I must tell you.
There's another master director that you have worked with already, Antoine Fuqua. And this is your biggest risk yet, possibly, isn't it? The Michael Jackson biopic.
Yeah, it's been an exciting 8 years now of working on it, because I started working on Michael the same time I started working on Moulin Rouge, the stage show. Wow. And so it's been 8 years of work, you know, and we're coming out next year. So it's exciting. Obviously, Michael Jackson's an incredibly complicated figure, a controversial figure in many ways. But to me, as an American dramatist, he was a great American story. Mm-hmm. And a great American character, and irresistible for that reason, because the stories that attract me usually have to do with who the protagonist is, whether it's Howard Hughes in The Aviator, or Vanessa Ives, who Ava Green played in Penny Dreadful, or Sweeney Todd. You know, it's those huge, interesting, fascinating characters that draw me. And Michael Jackson is clearly one of the great artists of the 20th century, and one of the most fascinating, vexing, and complicated men. So it's been quite a ride, and very gratifying to work on something that complicated.
Did you have freedom? Did you have independence from the estate, which owns obviously the music and will possibly own a big chunk of this film?
Total creative freedom. You know, Graham King, the producer who I worked with on The Aviator and Hugo and Rango, you know, is a titan in this industry, and he's a tiger. And he protected the vision all the way along, and has been just the most wonderful producer. And so I've never felt any pressure ever in terms of censorship or any pressure from the estate or anything. We're telling the story we want to tell.
Wow. Well, very excited about that film. You have, of course, the maniacal Michael Jackson fans to deal with as well. Are they in your mind at all?
No. I you know, if I started thinking that way, I never could have written Skyfall. You know, it's like I have incredible respect for the fan community. I myself am a fan of many things.
Yeah.
But when you sit down and you're facing the blank page or the blinking cursor, you just have to be true to what the story is. And so I hope people will like it. You know, I think they will. I always hope they will. But at the end of the day, you know, I have to look in the mirror and say, did I do my job? Did I do my job to the best of my ability? And that's the only person I'm responsible to.
Wow, that's going to be great. You've been so generous with your time, John, but I have to finish up with Penny Dreadful again, because you mentioned Vanessa Ives, and you're speaking to someone who has some of Sir Malcolm's wine tables in their house. I haven't bad with it. What did that show mean to you, Penny Dreadful? 3 seasons of it and the spin-off.
It was a dream come true, because I grew up as a monster kid, you know, loving Dark Shadows and Hammer films and Universal horror. Yeah. And I'd never done television before, but I sort of had this mad idea to like do a gothic mashup of incredible sort of creature characters from literature built around this fictional character, who's the character that Ava Green played. And it was all weirdly inspired by reading Wordsworth. You know, I just went through a period where I was reading a lot of romantic poetry, wow, particularly Wordsworth, very deeply into Wordsworth, which led to Shelley and Byron and finally back to Frankenstein, to Mary Shelley's novel. And that was the spark for the whole thing. So to get to do it in the first place, I'd never done a TV show before. I knew barely anything about running a show. And they get to write it, you know, and just write it sequentially, just keep writing it, making it complicated. And then working with the most phenomenal cast, you know, was a pleasure. And then I'm filming in Dublin and living in Merrion Square. And I meet my husband. So it's Big Red Bull holds a very important place in my heart.
There are some actually production set design pieces from Penny Dreadful still on the streets of Dublin, on Dame Lane and places like that, which you might
see. I know. Like little awnings we built for theatres and things. So, you know, whenever you walk around Temple Bar, there's like, oh, no, there's a little bit of Penny Dreadful still lingering. And I must say, you know, the people are very kind about the show. And I get a lot of people saying it was important to them because it is such a celebration of the different and the outcast and the unloved.
Yeah, because the Frankenstein character goes to incredible places.
It does. And that was where I started, as I say. And I you know, the first person we cast was my friend Rory Kinnear to play the creature. And I wanted to, you know, he's such a heartbreaking character in Mary Shelley's novel and so rarely presented like that.
Yeah.
I knew I had the time to really go into the poetry within the creature. And again, this is Mary Shelley's creation, not mine. And to have an actor like Rory play it and then to write those scenes where it's Ava Green and Rory Kinnear together was glorious. And that's why when I, spoiler alert, you know, when I was planning the end of the series to write the end, I knew I wanted it to be the idea of those two characters together because they were the sort of the glorious and heartbreaking core of the show to me.
Well, thank you for bringing it to Dublin. And of course, it was great to be around the streets of Dublin where Bram Stoker and Oscar Wilde and their stories had inspired so much of what you are writing. And enjoy your trip back to Dublin.
Thank you. Very much enjoyed it.
Will yourself and Tommy be stocking up on the Irish produce to bring back to California?
Yes, probably yes. Yeah, the chips. It's the Irish chips, which my husband is convinced are the best in the world. So we sent a load up with King Crisps on the way back.
Hopefully the tariffs haven't affected things when you return.
Yeah, no kidding.
Moulin Rouge, the musical, it opens at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin on the 20th of November. It runs until the 11th of January. Tickets are on sale right now. John Logan, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Oliver. Bye-bye.
Enjoy your day. Bye-bye.
Email oliver@rte.ie.